Hey there, this is Seth Wires from Channel 9 coming to you from Sandusky, Ohio. We are here for Codebash 2017, one of my favorite conferences. And I looked on the schedule and I saw there was a Rust talk.
Yep, I'm Carol Nichols. I do Rust. My talk was actually just Rust related.
Okay.
My talk was about how to disclose security vulnerability, which I found a security problem in Crates.io, which is the website that hosts all the Rust libraries that the community shares.
Interesting.
And I had to disclose it to the Rust security team. That it was an interesting experience. It was my first time disclosing a security problem, and it was the Rust security team's first security problem that they received. So it was an interesting experience for both of us, and we learned a lot.
That's awesome. That's like, hey, I have this thing, and they're like, oh, we've never seen one of those things. What do we do now? I don't know, let's talk about it.
They had a security policy in place before then, but this is the first time that it had been put in use. So it was a good practice run. It was not the biggest issue in the world, but it was a problem. Basically, it was looking up user records based on your GitHub username, and if you change your username, someone can claim your old username, which would mean that someone else could get control over the crates that you published, and that would be bad.
Is a crate like a package?
Yeah.
That makes sense. So that's awesome. I mean, I don't know, if I would have disclosed something like that, I'd probably have a t-shirt that says, I disclosed something, and look at me, I'm awesome, but you're probably nicer than that.
I tried to do a talk to share what I learned in the process with other people, in case other web developers like myself need to disclose something in the future.
So that's interesting. You say web developer, and you say Rust.
Yeah.
Like, to me, and I don't know very much, and so you're going to help educate us
Absolutely.
On this, I thought Rust was like a C++. Plus.
It is.
So why don't you give us sort of a framework for programmers, like how should we think about Rust, where does it belong, where does it fit, why
sure.
is it cool?
So it is a systems programming language, which is hard to kind of nail down what that is, because everything's a system. But it's lower level than something like Ruby or Java. It is on par with C and C++. It's trying to be an alternative to C and C++.
Okay.
You have control over the memory. You have lower level control to operating system type things. It's statically typed. It's compiled. So most of my experience is in Ruby, and it's kind of like swinging the other way.
Oh yeah,
like,
completely.
Because I did like Java in college, and then I'm like Ruby is great. You can just do anything and type, and it looks like English, and it's fun, and it's great. I have a lot of fun, and I like Ruby a lot. But I got tired of seeing undefined method on nil all the time. So another thing that Rust has is no concept of nil, no nullable pointers. You have like the option type, like Haskell does,
right.
And the compiler ensures that you handle when you have something or when you have nothing. So you're never gonna have nothing when you thought you had something. And that's, you find that out at compile time, not like in production at runtime. So I enjoy Ruby. I've spent a lot of my time doing performance tuning of Rails apps and things like that. And so I love making things go faster. And I wanted to make my career go more towards lower level backend stuff to make things go faster, but I'm terrified of C.
I know.
I should be nowhere near production C. Yeah.
Me too.
Yeah. So that's about the time that Rust came along, and I got really interested in it because of all the compiler checks that it has. It lets me be confident about the code that I'm writing, that I'm not shooting myself in the foot. But I can get that speed. I can get that control.
That's kind of cool. So you're telling me that Rust gets rid of like the billion-dollar mistake.
Yes, that's one of the benefits.
One of the benefits. So that's the first one. You mentioned it had option types, which mm-hmm. is very similar to the functional programming languages.
Yes, there's definitely some functional influences with Rust, mm-hmm. But I wouldn't call it a functional language. It's
right. It's
got a lot of different influences, but it's inspired by ML and Haskell, and there's iterators that let you do functional mappy kind of things.
Like lazy type operations. Mm-hmm. Okay. So let's. I feel like we talked about. You can show me something,
sure.
and we can start to get a feel. Because I usually look at a language and I start to get a sense for like its feeling. It's like a piano, you know.
Yeah.
You walk
yeah.
in there and this piano, you know. Oh, is this kind of piano? Yeah. So let's take a look at what you got.
Yeah. Okay. So the no nullable references is probably one of the benefits. The biggest benefits that people usually talk about is a guaranteed memory safety. So this is what really makes me feel confident in compared to C. Mm-hmm. Rust makes it impossible at compile time to have use after freeze, double freeze, or data erases mm-hmm. because of the thing called the borrow checker that enforces a certain set of rules that means that the memory will always be safe to access. And it checks those at compile time, so there's no runtime penalty for that.
So you're obviously a lot smarter than me at this. When I did my C and my C++ stuff, I would create a pointer and then I would allocate memory.
Right.
And then from that pointer, I would just reference stuff and pull stuff out and do whatever. And then I'd have to deallocate that memory. Sometimes I would forget the last part and things would go all over the place.
Yes.
What, how do you, are you allocating memory like pointers in Rust?
Yes.
Okay.
But then the cleaning up part of it is more automatic than it is in C. So you can't forget because Rust enforces this for you. And I can demonstrate.
Let's do it.
So what I've got here is a playground. So another thing I'd like to plug is that I'm a co-founder of a consulting company called Integer 32.
Awesome.
One of our projects that my partner built, Jake Goulding, so there's also a play.rustlang.org, mm-hmm. which is another playground. He built a similar playground that lets you run, it's not running in the browser, it's running on a server, but it lets you play with Rust code the browser. And the Integer 32 version lets you use libraries. So that was an extra feature that he added on here. So we're going to be using that to demonstrate Rust because it's a convenient way to try some things out. So what I've got here is I've defined down here a struct called DVD player, mm-hmm. and it has the name of the DVD that you're going to be playing.
Mm-hmm.
And in the main function here, that's going to be our entry point to the function. We're making a new DVD player object, instance. We're going to be watching the movie Say Anything, and then we're going to pass the player to this function named uPlay. And actually, no, let's take that out for a second.
Okay.
So what happens here is this is allocating memory. And then when player is called the owner of this memory.
Okay.
And when the owner of memory goes out of scope, which it does at the end of the main function, it gets automatically cleaned up.
It looks like you're also using let as opposed to, so this is like an implicit sort of type inference.
Yeah, so this is statically typed, but there's inference involved here. So I could annotate the type here, and sometimes you have to, but most of the time
it can infer
what type you're using. So there are a lot of rules, but it's less verbose than some statically typed languages I found.
Sure, love it.
So we can take that back out. So we've got our instance here, and it gets cleaned up at the end of this function.
That's interesting. So when it allocates memory, it's not, because I was going to ask, is it like a garbage collector? It's not.
No, there's no garbage collection
because when the scope is gone, the memory is sort of put in, and this is part of the compiler that does all this work for you. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
So the next thing you might want to do is transfer ownership to a different function. So we're going to do that. This function that I've defined here named uPlay mm-hmm. Takes a DVD player as an argument, and when we do that, what this function is doing is taking ownership. So this will compile, and it's giving me some warnings, but it compiled and ran, and it's not really doing anything mm-hmm. right now. But if we try to call this again in main, this is not going to compile. And it's going to say, you used a move value, because the first time we called it, player gets transferred into this function, and uPlay then owns it, and it gets cleaned up at this curly brace.
Oh, I see.
So then this player is now invalid in main, so that's how it enforces multiple things accessing things, and multiple things trying to clean things up. So when you transfer ownership, you're transferring who is responsible for cleaning up that memory.
So how do you make it so that I could use player in a different function, for example?
Yeah, so then what you'd want to do is this function is just calling the play function. It's mm-hmm. it's not changing anything. It just kind of needs to read.
Right.
So if we add ampersand here.
It's a reference.
It's a reference. So, and Rust calls this a borrow. So this says this function now isn't going to take ownership of its argument. It's just going to borrow it. And at the end of the function, the borrow is over, and it, the person who originally owned, not person, but code that originally owned it still keeps ownership. So we have to add an ampersand here, too, and here. And if we didn't, the compiler would say the types don't match. But now we can run this, and now it's compiling and running again. Because and we could call this function twice because we just borrowed it and player still is the owner and it's still getting cleaned up at the end of main and not at the end of the
That's
function.
So clever.
Yeah. So there are more rules involving borrowing. So you can have multiple immutable borrows in one scope, but only ever one mutable borrow. So Rust is also immutable by default, but you can make things mutable with a mute keyword. Mm-hmm. So if this function was changing something about its argument, we can say we want a mutable borrow, and then we would have to follow the rules to make sure that there's only one mutable borrow outstanding in any particular
before,
scope.
Because it might spawn something else, and it might try to two things might try to access
right.
the same memory so and cause a race condition.
This is the part that prevents data races, and this also applies across threads. So this is making concurrency a lot easier to get right and checking that at compile time, which is really, really cool.
Oh, man. Yeah, I had to write an operating system in C once in college.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
The dude checked our memory leaks. It was horrible.
I had that course and I was so lost and I just went to the office hours every week because I was just completely lost. But there's a couple of classes. There was one at UVA that was using Rust to teach operating systems, which I think is really cool.
You see, but when I did my operating system class, I go to my professor, hey, can I use C++? He's like, yeah, good luck. And he laughed at me. And then I was like, I don't think I'm going to try it. But that's amazing that Rust, you can write an operating system with Rust.
Yes, there are multiple efforts to write different kinds of operating systems. Intermezzos is a project that Steve Klobnik started that is a teaching operating system. So exactly for teaching in a class. I don't know if Intermezzos is being used in any classes right now, but it's trying to introduce system programming to new people.
Interesting. So we talked about the notion of memory allocation and that memory allocation and deallocation doesn't happen with malloc and free. It literally is the scope of the variable and this notion of borrowing and passing mutable stuff.
So it's kind of RAII. I don't really like that acronym because it's weird to say, but it's kind of when you are done with something, it gets cleaned up kind of automatically.
That's awesome.
That's the pattern.
So what else is there about Rust that you like?
Oh, I just had something that I was going to say a second ago. So I like that it lets us make new mistakes.
Okay.
I feel like it's advancing programming.
I see.
There was a DHH blog post a little while ago that was let them have knives. Let the programmers be able to do potentially dangerous and risky things. And that's your professional responsibility to make sure that your code doesn't
Sure, sure, sure.
Historically, we have not been good at that.
It's like running with scissors with some of us.
Right, yeah. So, I don't really agree with that philosophy. I think computers are good at keeping track of really tedious stuff that you have to, if you want to try and reduce the number of bugs in your program, you have to keep track of really tedious stuff. You have to keep track of those mallocs and frees and make sure they're happening in the right order in the right place all the time, no matter how many threads. That's really hard to keep in your head.
Right.
And historically, if you look at the CVE database, we have not done a good job of this.
No.
So I want the computer to help me as much as it possibly can. And these rules in the Rust compiler, I feel like, are helping to write better software.
Interesting.
So I think it's really powerful, and I am excited to see. Rust is still pretty young. The 1.0 version came out in May 2015, so it's not even been 2 years that it's been 1.0 yet. The ecosystem is growing. The standard library is pretty small, but there are lots of crates, as we talked about, crates that you can install and bring into your project to do whatever you want to do. So that ecosystem is constantly growing. And I'm really excited to see what happens as the Rust community grows.
So two questions. The first one is, let's go back to that code that we built before. I didn't see any notion of classes. Does it have classes? Is it all just functions?
Structs are probably the closest thing it has to classes. So structs are just like the data field parts of a class. And then this block here, we have an implementation block on DVD player. And because this function defined in here takes self, this is a method on this struct. And then in here, we call this method on it. So that's kind of the behavior part of classes. And then there's there isn't inheritance, but there is traits, which are kind of like interfaces in Java is what they feel most like to me. But they're kind of inspired by Haskell type classes. So that with that, you can kind of define a contract of functions that and what those arguments and return types are. And then you can implement a trait on whatever type you want. And then you can have other things that say that they take a generic thing that implements that trait. So that's kind of how you can share code between different structs or enums.
The basic data types then are structs,
there's enums,
and then you can have traits on those things.
Yes.
Okay, anything else beyond that that's kind of interesting?
There's a bunch of standard library types, and there's some smarter pointers. So there are RC reference counted types that you can have, mutexes and different kinds of smart pointers like that. The vec and string standard library types are structs under the hood, but you can use them as collections.
Got it.
And they have a lot of neat methods on them.
Awesome. The other question I have is regarding crates, because it feels like those are packages, or in Node they would be called packages.
Yeah.
In .NET they're NuGet packages.
Yeah.
Tell us a little bit about sort of the stuff that's already available. So I'm looking at the numbers there, like 101 million downloads.
Yep,
is pretty good.
We just crossed this bar over the other day. So there's 7,000 distinct libraries in here. And the fact that Cargo is like the command line tool that helps you manage your dependencies and things like that. And that's actually kind of innovative for the system programming space.
Yeah, of course.
So
are you kidding me?
We've always
like .h
right,
files and
yes.
Wondering where the heck everything is.
Yes, and you don't have that library installed? Like,
yeah.
how are you supposed to know that you need to have some library in the right spot
right.
And where is it looking? And yeah. So this is, but in the Ruby and JavaScript space, like developers are used to having this. So this was something that Rust kind of launched with and has been really helpful in sharing code and building code and producing reproducible things. If we look at like there's new crates, most downloaded, just updated. So for instance, RAND, random number generation, is not in the standard library, which is a little weird because one of the first things you might try and do is generate some random numbers. But then you have to install a crate for that. So that also is a little different. Like systems programmers, because they don't have a nice package manager, are often reluctant to install lots of dependencies. But Cargo really makes it easy. So, and that also gives the Rust language and standard library have made really strong guarantees since they went to 1.0 about backwards compatibility. But the libraries, we want to be able to evolve them separately. And so the fact that it's so easy to bring in libraries has really made the stability of the standard library and the innovation in the crates possible.
That's really cool. So let's talk about sort of installing on a local machine.
Mm-hmm.
Is there like a MSI installer for Windows, a PKG for Mac, and whatever for Linux? Is it just
so
an apt-get? Oh, there
best,
you go.
The best. So it's we're working on getting it into package managers and operating systems. RustUp is the official easy way to get Rust installed, and it helps you manage versions because a new version comes out every 6 weeks.
I see.
So this is showing me the OS X instructions because I'm on OS X, and it's your standard curl to bash. On Windows, they have an installer, and there's MSVC and GNU toolchains. Cross compatibility is a big part of Rust, and being able to compile and package things for different operating systems. So RustUp is actually written in Rust and works on Windows because Rust is supposed to work.
And that's a hard thing, especially for systems programming.
Yeah.
Because the architectures might be completely different and the system calls are different. It's just,
yeah.
It's a hard thing to do.
Yeah, so that's another reason that I am interested in Rust, because Ruby, I used to do Ruby on Windows, and that was painful.
Can I tell you how painful, as I work for Microsoft? We actually made Linux work on Windows just to make Ruby better.
Yeah.
I mean, that's how committed we were for Ruby devs. So we have something called the Bash shell that will run pure Linux processes on top of our kernel, which is really cool. And so I feel your pain. So this is why this is really interesting.
Yeah. So there are some differences, and there are some crates and things that you have to tweak a little bit to work on Windows. And I ran a workshop. We're trying to do Rust Bridge, like Rails Bridge. We've only had two in the world so far, but we're working on getting workshops like that too. But we had Windows people, and we tried to use OpenSSL on Windows, and getting that to compile right was a little bit iffy, but people are trying to make it better all the time. And Windows is a tier one platform that the Rust community is interested in supporting, as well as the other platforms. So it's important to the community.
So this is all awesome. You mentioned that you were a web developer.
Yeah.
Are you a web developer with Rust now, or are you now moved over to systems programming with Rust, or is there a way to do web with Rust? I'm trying to see.
There are a couple things that are coming out. Nothing quite on the level of Rails yet. Okay. It's still a little bit not quite so easy. There's a framework called Iron that lets you do some web development stuff. One that just came out, and I'm going to see if it, so Rocket just came out the other day, and I think, let's take a look at their homepage. So this is trying to make web development easy, but this is still very early in Rocket's history.
Well, it's a beautiful website.
But yeah, they've put a lot of effort into documentation. We're trying to build a documentation culture into Rust. And so I haven't tried out Rocket yet, but it looks pretty cool. So here's a little example they've got here about what Rocket looks like. So it looks like your standard get stuff, and you're doing, writing some output and mounting your routes. So they're
That's
trying to
awesome.
Make it look and be as easy. So it's not quite there yet. I wouldn't say let's go rewrite all the web apps in Rust quite yet, but there are people getting there. So I've done a bunch of work on Crates.io itself, and Crates.io's backend is written in Rust. So I do a little bit of web development in Rust.
Nice. Well, this has been super helpful. I love looking at new languages. I love looking at people's perspective on new languages. I really love the way the references are counted and sort of the memory is freed, and I love the borrowing and such. I love the way that the types are implicitly and statically implicitly typed. I like the idea of cargo as well as systems programming, for me, mere mortal. So thanks so much for spending some time with us.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks so much for watching again. Is there any way someone can reach you, like on Twitter, if you have any questions?
I'm Carol Stensens on Twitter.
Awesome. Well, again, thanks so much for watching. My name is Seth Juarez. This is Channel 9. We're at Codemash 2017. We've learned all about Rust. Thanks for watching. We'll see you next time. Take care.